Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As the school year gets underway, more students than ever will be armed with their own smartphone. In the past, phones have been a no-no in the classroom, but the proliferation of education and lifestyle-related apps have made them a near necessity for many. Joining us now is tech writer Caitlin Wells, who has written about the topic for Consumer Reports. Caitlin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the planner. It's called Studious. It sets class schedules and homework deadlines. What all does it do?
Well, Studious is a really great app. I mean, as you know, you can't start the school year without a student planner. And as a digital one, this one is pretty great. So what you can actually do with it, just like a paper planner, you can add your class schedules. You can also input your homework deadlines, and you can store notes and photos. That's something a little additional there. But what I really love about this app is that once you set your class schedule, Studious actually silences your phone during the corresponding class time. So for those of us who forget to silence our phones in class, this app will truly come in handy.
I thought the silencing the phone was the best part of it, too. Is that what makes it better than, say, the Google Calendar or Apple Calendars?
Yes, I definitely think so. And the fact that you can also add little additional notes and images to the planner also makes it stand out, which can be a little tricky in Google Calendar.
Is it an app that works for a tablet as well?
Yes, it can work for tablets, but it's limited to Android devices. For the majority of these that I'm highlighting, we're going to stick to mobile devices, but a lot of them do have extensions for the tablet.
Okay, so how much does it cost? And just in general, how much are a lot of these apps costing?
Well, that's another bonus. They're all free.
Oh.
Yeah, so, you're in college. You're already spending a lot on tuition and books, so why not get something for free?
Yeah, no kidding. Now, it depends on, though. First, you have to input all the information, and you have to be sort of meticulous about that, right? You have to be organized in the first place.
You really do have to be organized, but that's just the same that comes with any paper planner or when you're starting a new school year. You want to be on top of your game, and we're moving more and more to the digital devices, so why not do it in that?
Now, here's a study aid. It's called Study Blue. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, when you're in college, you're going to take a lot of exams, and you're going to need a study aid or two. So Study Blue is a good one to have in your study arsenal. When you're taking those entry-level courses, those typically focus on multiple choice tests. So Study Blue comes in handy because it's a great app that lets you create digital flashcards. So you create these digital flashcards, and you can upload your study materials to review on your computer or your smartphone. You can have it while you're on the go, or if you want a larger screen, you can use it on your computer. So while you're taking, a practice exam and focusing on your flashcards like you would with paper flashcards, this app will even filter out the flashcards you know by heart and can answer quickly. That way you can focus on the terms and topics that you should really be studying.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Caitlin Wells. She's a tech writer, and she's written about education, college-related apps and organizational apps for Consumer Reports. If you have a question or comment, if you have an idea for a good app for a new student or a returning student this fall, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. As far as the flashcards go, how do they work? I mean, something pops up on the screen and you click your mouse. How does that work?
Well, how they work is you get a little prompt screen to go through a chart and add, like say it's Spanish, you add all of your terms in English and Spanish, so you've got sign one and sign two of the cards. Mm-hmm. Then you go ahead and sort it, and that's exactly what it does. It'll pop up your little digital card, give you the term, ask you, to if you know it. If you do, you check it off. If not, it goes back into the pile, and you just slowly filter through cards until you know everything by heart.
It works with Evernote, too. Why is that a benefit?
It's a benefit because you can really sync with your Evernote notes. So that is another popular app. And say you want to get a really good study session going with something that's a little more intuitive, then you'll definitely want to use Evernote under the productivity section.
Okay, so while you're at school, one of the biggest learning experiences of all is banking, personal banking. And you brought up a finance app called mobile, or you wrote about mobile banking apps as well. They're available for most major banks, including Bank of America, Capital One, Chase, Citibank, and Wells Fargo. Tell us about those.
Yeah, these are really great because in college, you know, you're on the go a lot or you're busy with classes or extracurriculars, so you don't always have time to get to the bank when you need to, especially say if a relative or a grandparent sends you, you know, a check in the mail to help with your bills. So what I love about the mobile banking app nowadays is that you can actually snap a photo of that check and digitally deposit into your bank account. So all you need is your smartphone and the app, which is free, and you'll deposit just like that. And you can also do other things with the app, just as you would with going into the bank. You can transfer funds, you can pay your bills, and it's just a great app to have.
How can it work that you can just take a picture of a check and digitally deposit that? How does that even work?
Well,
who falls for that?
The first time you do use the apps, it will have a little disclaimer saying, you know, the processing time may take a little bit longer, up to 2 weeks generally. So what you do is you sign the check as you normally would. You take a picture of the front and the back and put the data with which account you want it to go into and the amount of the check. Then they verify it and it gets deposited. And after that first time, the turnaround is pretty quickly, pretty similar to as it would be at the ATM. But just make sure you don't deposit the check twice and hold on to the paper check until you see it's been deposited in your account. And then you should destroy it properly.
You should what?
Destroy it properly.
Destroy it. Okay.
Yeah.
And that remains a record in your phone.
It's a record in your mobile banking app or on your online checking account.
Okay.
So it's there wherever you go to see it. It'll look like just a regular ATM deposit.
Another idea is the idea of getting away from school that you brought up. You wrote about the TripIt travel organizer. Part of the challenge, of course, is travel for a lot of students. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the TripIt travel organizer is really a good app to have around the holidays. It actually syncs your email confirmations to your phone. So, for example, when you book a flight online and you get that email confirmation, the app will automatically scan your email and import all of that information into the app. So there's no more searching for that flight number in an email that you probably deleted 2 months back. You can also set it to give yourself directions. So say you book a hotel and a flight. It'll automatically add that information in for you and tell you the best route to get from the airport to the hotel. And you can sync your flight schedules to your smartphone calendar, and you can also share your itinerary with a friend.
Beth in Clintonville, you have an idea for an app? Hi.
It's not as high-tech of an app, but it comes with Google. It's called, Recorder or Mic, and it's just a little microphone on your phone. It's free. You can record your lecture notes. It's all audio. You can use it if you're interviewing a subject or a subject matter expert and you need their information for your master's program, which I had it when I had my master's program. And it's just a nice thing to have. You can save it. You save all your notes. And then if you, another one that's pretty easy to use is your video that comes with your phone.
Right.
And you can save that too. As long as you have enough memory on your card, you can do that as well. And,
okay.
I mean, Samsung has some pretty fancy features. It showed me not only can you record your video, but you can also be taking individual snapshots at the same time.
Okay. Beth, thanks a lot for that call. Caitlin Wells, security, another issue. A lot of students, particularly new college students, aren't as concerned about it, say, in high school, but they're into a lot more stuff once they get to college.
Yes, definitely. They're into a lot more stuff. They have a lot more expensive equipment. So it's important to make sure that your mobile devices are secure. In fact, today, the FTC says that approximately 40% of robberies in big cities now involve a mobile device. So one way to keep your cell phone secure is to install and enable a security app like Find My iPhone for iPhone or Find My Phone for Android. So you'll definitely appreciate having that if, you know, you're unfortunate enough to need it. So using your smartphone's locator services, these apps can actually locate your phone if it's ever lost or stolen. It'll ping the sound to help you find it. They can lose it in the couch cushion, or they can also remotely wipe data from a connected device such as a laptop if it is truly stolen. Something else you'll want to make sure you do or have your students do is that they should have a passlock code or a security code enabled on the phone to prevent thieves from accessing your private data. So every time you go to pick up your phone and make a call, you'll have to enter that passcode, but it's really an important security feature that I think that everyone should have.
Okay. Well, Caitlin Wells, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Caitlin Wells is a tech writer. We were talking about an article she wrote recently for Consumer Reports. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Tech Tuesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The word archaeologist usually conjures images of hand picks, gravel, and dinosaur bones. Digital archaeology, not necessarily at all. Still, excavation has begun to preserve the earliest records of internet life before it disappears. Joining us now is the host of the Internet History Podcast, Brian McCullough. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Ann.
So how did it occur to you to start up with this Internet History Project?
Well, actually, like I like to tell people, I'm just kind of writing the book that I wish someone had already written, but it apparently hasn't. The tech industry is really sort of, the next new app or the next new software version or whatever. And as an industry, we're not really very good at preserving our own history. And now that technology is sort of all of our histories, it's becoming more and more important to do that.
Your project, the Internet History Podcast, is a crowdsourced history of the Internet. Why did you decide to make the project interactive? And how do people get involved?
Well, they can get involved by listening and going to the website and everything. Essentially, by doing it on the internet, doing it as a podcast, I'm able to, if I was just going to write a history book, I would reach out to people for interviews and say to them, well, maybe 2 years from now, you'll be able to see what you said in print. But by doing a podcast, I can go to people and say, talk to me, and I can put it up in your own words.
You've said that only about 3% of the stuff online in 1996 is still around. How do you track that down in the first place?
Well, essentially what I'm doing for the podcast, when I do a chapter on, say, the history of Yahoo or AOL, is I'm looking for, a lot of the first-person accounts, and a lot of those things are missing. Just as an example, Newsweek magazine is going through some sort of a reorg right now, and there's about 15 years of online reporting, online stories from Newsweek.com that I don't have access to. And so as I've been doing this project, yeah, it's sort of been disturbing. That's just my own guesstimation. I would say that you can only find about 3% of what was on the web prior to 1996. The numbers get better around 2000. But even through 2004, I'd say you'd be lucky if you could find even 60% of what was online, say, in the year 2001.
You wrote about an early website that has mostly disappeared. Tell us about Pathfinder.com.
Right. Pathfinder was actually, I would think, really the first web portal. It launched in the fall of 1994, and it was the the web efforts of, at the time, Time Incorporated, which would eventually become Time Warner. And so it launches as a major initiative with hundreds of workers and hundreds of millions of dollars spent launching it at around the same time as Yahoo. So for a good 4 or 5 years in the mid to late 90s, one of the top 10 websites in the world in terms of traffic numbers, page views, things like that, was Pathfinder.com. And it eventually met the fate of a lot of things. Corporate reorg, again, said that Pathfinder was no longer the website that Time Warner wanted to pursue, and so it disappeared. And along with it disappeared, what I would consider to be some of the first blogs. There was a major news site called Netly News, which was one of the first web-centric and web-only news reporting sites. And so that's what happens if we don't start to consider preserving some of our digital history, is that, you might think that those photos from, a party in 2005 that are on MySpace are always there to haunt you, but who's to say that MySpace will be around 2 or 3 years from now?
Why is it when, in other words, any kind of website needs to be maintained to a certain degree?
Sure. And, one of the problems is that we're not dealing with the physical world. There's always going to be a magazine in a library. I can always go back and find the physical Newsweek editions. But when it's a blog post or a blog post that has interesting comments on it, they might decide to redesign the website tomorrow. And, a great blog post that has 500 interesting comments in a thread will suddenly just disappear. And, there's no one going around printing out physically that blog post. And, it's even little things like if you do think of things like your own photos or your check-ins on Foursquare, you assume that those things will always be there. But that assumption also is that company will survive, that it won't get bought up and turned into something else, or that they won't change the product. And so they'll no longer host your photos or your check-ins or something like that.
How do you find and preserve or record old websites if you can't find them online? You mentioned how would you do that besides printing it out?
Well, there are initiatives that try to preserve by caching existing websites. The one that's the most popular is the Internet Archive with their famous Wayback Machine, and that is a go kick them some money, because that is a nonprofit private effort to do just that. There are old companies that I started back in the early 2000s that I can go back to and see, well, this is what that homepage looked like in 2001, even though that company's long gone. And there are other people that are trying to do things. There's a guy I read an article about in The Atlantic recently that is trying to preserve the Prodigy network. I don't know if you remember Prodigy. It was actually along the lines of AOL. It was an early dial-up internet service, not even an internet service originally, just an online service. And he was able to find, stored on disks, the entire Prodigy system. And he is trying to port that to the World Wide Web, so that people would hopefully be able to access it, via a web browser and go back and look at what people were doing on Prodigy for years.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Brian McCullough. He's host of the Internet History Podcast. We're talking about internet archaeology, finding and preserving the internet of the past and what it means to us going forward. If you have a question or comment for Brian McCullough, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Brian, tell us again, why is it important for us to preserve the internet? And do you think it's possible ultimately, even if we started doing all of this today, that it's even possible to do it?
Well, I think at the very least we need to start thinking about it, because what would you say now? Maybe 70, 80, 90% of our lives are now lived online in terms of your most important conversations, your most important photos. Hmm. Your bank statements, your health records, things like that. So if more and more of our everyday life is online, then we could face a situation where if we don't start thinking about preserving it, that 100 years from now, historians will think of this as a dark age, where things that they used to be able to go find records for will suddenly, they won't be able to find anything for this period of time, because as we do more and more things online, that's where the interesting parts of our lives are. If they're not preserved, then we're going to lose that completely. Now, conversely, if we do start thinking about it, then as opposed to being a dark age, we might think of everything up until this point as a dark age, because think of all the things that we can preserve now. I wrote a piece on Medium about this where I made the analogy that, you know, I live in Park Slope in Brooklyn, and Barack Obama lived a few blocks away from me when he was a young man in Park Slope. And I was thinking, if he lived here now, we'd be able to see, you know, his check-ins. We'd be able to see his Facebook posts about parties that he went to, people that he met, lectures he attended, things like that. So out there right now, there's someone that is going to be our next president, and she is maybe engaged in things about, like say, the debate about the Ferguson issue. And she's making blog posts and comments and things, and this is something that's going to shape her political career. And wouldn't you like to know that sometime in the future? Wouldn't you like to be able to see, you know, the classes that, say, Einstein attended in his day?
Yeah, I kind of do see what you're saying. Maybe back in the day, people wrote letters, they made speeches, that kind of stuff. They wrote the speeches down and they were saved for prosperity. A lot of stuff happens more spontaneously than that. And if it does, then it's gone forever. And it tells us something about the person.
Exactly. Again, if more and more of our meaningful lives, of our creative lives, of our intellectual lives are being lived and recorded online, I think the problem is that we all assume that these things, you know, once it gets on the internet, you can't erase it. And there's things like the Google right to be forgotten lawsuits in Europe. But what I'm saying is that I've found quite the opposite to be true, because there is no system in place to comprehensively preserve things. So again, good luck finding your Friendster page from 2003, or some people might remember there were things like GeoCities, and you know, millions of people made GeoCities pages, and GeoCities was shut down by Yahoo a few years ago. So again, who knows? There could be a future Einstein who had a great science-based GeoCities page, and wouldn't we love to, you know, go back and see that after he cures cancer?
What entity do you envision taking this in hand?
I don't know that it would be an entity so much as it's something that web companies and tech companies need to be aware of. I mean, think about the fact that Facebook, when it started, all of a sudden it realized it had to have some sort of a mechanism in place for when somebody died. Because they realized that, you know, someone would die suddenly and their friends and family would want to preserve their Facebook page. And, you know, they had no system in place for that. But they realized that was something that, over the course of people becoming enamored with Facebook, that was something that was logical and natural. So now they have mechanisms in place for this sort of thing. So I think that tech companies need to, at the very least, start thinking about creating some sort of a regime, either internally or as some sort of an industry standard, where apps, websites, things that we join personally, that we share our lives on, that these can be preserved, that they could be handed down to generations, that they could be made available to historians in the future. It's just, again, my concern is that this is something that no one has ever actually ever thought about, and we need to start thinking about it.
Now, when I think of reading Thomas Jefferson's letters, I don't think of it as a breach of privacy, but that it seems to take on a different feel when we talk about giving, you know, who gets access, when do they get access, how would that be policed?
That's true, and I mean, that's a perfect example from history. The reason that we know what the founding fathers thought when they were forming the country is because they were they were crazy corresponders, and they preserved their letters. A lot of them were diarists. They preserved their diaries, and those were collected as a part of their estate. So again, this would be something that perhaps lawyers might need to start taking a look at and considering. Part of your estate going forward will be your digital life. It won't just be your children and your grandchildren going through your photo albums. It'll be, you know, going into your laptop and going into your Facebook page and going into your Twitter account and things like that, and preserving what you feel like you want to preserve and what they feel like they want to preserve. And in terms of the issue of privacy, again, that's another debate. I'm, of course, not saying that we should all record our lives and make them, make, you know, every second, everything that we had for lunch available to posterity. But it is possible to do all those things. This is the greatest historical tool ever devised. So maybe let's start thinking about when it might be appropriate to preserve some of this stuff.
I've always thought it was kind of interesting, particularly with Facebook pages, after people have died, the families or people keep the Facebook page going, and it's sort of a place you can go to remember that person. But what if they just went away? That's an interesting point.
Right, exactly. But, you know, again, for historical purposes, you know, we know so much about Nixon because he kept a tape recorder going all the time. Now he wishes he didn't. There could be some historical figure in the future that, again, you know, you can think of it in a negative sense. If someone does something horrible and you want to go through their online profile and see, well, this is when they started to, you know, be radicalized or turn bad or something like that. But you can think of it in a positive way as well. You know, again, using Foursquare as an example, Foursquare is that app where you check into places. Well, when Bob Dylan hit New York City in the early 60s, wouldn't you love to see his Facebook check-ins as the first time he visits Cafe Wa, or the first time he plays at this club or that club, or the first time he sees that other performer play? Those are things that, again, seem mundane at the time, would seem mundane to you when you're doing it, but you don't know what history would find fascinating.
And it's interesting because you do make the point. I mean, we are crazy about recording everything we do these days. What if the record could be made of that and we could look back and see what people did? It would be pretty amazing. We have an email from Dorian who writes, how does this impact public records retention?
That's a bit beyond my ken. I'm not sure. I mean, obviously you would think that as things are digital, it would be cheaper to store as opposed to having, you know, warehouses full of paper records. But in this age of, you know, municipalities and states having tight budgets, I don't know, are there efforts being made to digitize records, to save the records that are digitized? I don't believe that anybody is thinking about that. And again, if we don't start thinking about it, then the risk we're running is that, again, historians hundreds of years from now will say, yeah, the internet was when everybody really, there was an explosion of creativity and activity. But man, those first 30 years, we really just don't know anything about it because they never bothered to save any of it.
And when you're talking about digitizing and how to save it, are you talking about hard copies on CDs, on that kind of a thing?
Sure. I mean, you know, a lot of us are not yet comfortable in trusting things like the cloud, but, you know, maybe there needs to be a company that goes in and helps municipalities, you know, federal organizations with their records and say, all right, listen, here's how you're going to preserve these things for posterity, the digital posterity that hopefully would be, you know, on into infinity. I'd love to know what sort of efforts, like the Library of Congress, are they leading these sorts of efforts? You know, pictures, the first pictures, you know, from the Civil War. I'm assuming that people are going around digitizing those because those are, you know, fragile physical things that won't last forever. I would like to think that there's a concerted effort to save things like, you know, Hollywood films and photos and things like that. I would hope so. And if not, then this is exactly what we're talking about. We need to start thinking about that.
All right. Well, Brian McCullough, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Brian McCullough, he's the host of the Internet History Podcast. If you want a link to that, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Tech Tuesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the olden days, the first day of school was all about that new pair of shoes. Now it's all about that new laptop when it comes to the start of the school year. Joining us now from Geek.com is tech blogger Russell Holley to talk about that and more. Russell, welcome back.
Thanks.
So you wanted to talk about the relative advantages of Microsoft's Surface Pro 3 versus Apple's MacBook Air. But before we do that, what goes into your mind? What are you thinking about when you think about that first laptop going off to college sort of a thing?
Well, so the first school laptop, at least the laptop that I wish that I had when I was going to school, is the one that was, you know, the most portable. It was the, you know, that combination of portability and power. You know, my first laptop when I was in college was a really clunky thing. I had to make sure I had an extra durable backpack because it was, you know, that stuff plus my books, and it just became really tiresome. So I feel like portability is a really big deal today. And we have so many different devices that are capable of being, you know, 2 pounds and 3 pounds as, you know, complete solutions instead of having just that being the weight of the power supply. So I think that that's probably the best thing, is being able to kind of match that performance and portability crossroad.
So you wanted to talk about the Surface Pro 3 versus the MacBook Air. Microsoft recently released Surface Pro 3, and MacBook Air by Apple remains a popular model. Tell us what you looked at with those.
Well, so their pricing points are relatively similar. Microsoft's lowest version of the Surface Pro 3 is a little cheaper than the MacBook Air. So if you go for that, then if price is a pretty significant factor for you in choosing a laptop, then it's also the least expensive version at its lowest end. But you know, comparing them with very similar hardware, MacBook Air, the biggest disadvantage to owning a MacBook Air, if you're looking at just the hardware, is the display. It's just not nearly as good as what Microsoft put in the Surface Pro 3. The resolution is a lot lower. The ability to perform in direct sunlight is not quite as good. And there's no touch capabilities. And while touch is not a huge deal for most people, especially if you're in school, the ability to take notes just by pulling out the little pen and write, like physically writing notes on the screen, is really helpful. I've found that I use it a lot. And a lot of the students that I talk to who are currently in school using Surface Pro 3 is also really appreciate the feature.
With the Surface Pro 3, can you turn it into a tablet?
Absolutely, yeah. They actually have a tablet by default, and you can add a keyboard to it.
Okay.
If you choose to. So it's really, they try to, you know, pitch it as this kind of hybrid laptop and tablet. I find that I use it more as a laptop than I ever would as a tablet, but it is still perfectly capable as both.
Do they handle the same processors?
They handle the same processors. Almost all of the same applications exist on both systems. It's interesting that, you know, you really couldn't technically go wrong choosing one or the other. I think that the Surface Pro 3 is the better machine, just for, like I said, that crossroads of portability and performance. But they really are both great machines with great operating systems that run a ton of different applications. I think most colleges and high schools are more Windows friendly, just because that's what their internal staff know how to work with. You know, that's obviously not 100% true. There are some art schools that I've been to that have a lot of Apple specific software that end up being used. But the barrier between these two platforms, between Microsoft and Apple, is so thin nowadays that, you know, if it doesn't run in a browser, chances are it runs on both machines anyway.
So going back to the touchscreen issue, that's a pretty big deal, isn't it? What is Apple just not going there?
Well, I mean, Apple has it with the iPad, and
right?
In order to make OS X, you know, the operating system for Mac, really touch compliant, they have to make a lot of pretty significant changes to how the operating system looks and runs. And I just don't think that Apple's ready to make that change yet and have it be functional, you know, especially because a lot of people who use the Mac operating system use it in a desktop environment. And as we found with Windows 8 and Windows 8.1, it was really jarring for a lot of people to install Windows 8.1 on a traditional desktop and realize that there are so many things that feel like they should be touch friendly that you know, just kind of look awkward when you try to use them with the mouse. And while Microsoft has ironed out a lot of that with Windows 8.1, it would be really damaging to Apple's UI to make those same changes overnight. I think it'll be a gradual thing, and touch will get added within the next couple of years.
That might be too late if people are desiring it now on their laptops.
That's certainly possible, but I feel like Apple has a fairly documented history of being called too late and then doing really cool things in the end.
Okay, and you said that the Touch Pro 3 is a much better display resolution. Battery life, comparable?
The MacBook Air is definitely going to get you battery life over the Surface Pro 3, and that actually works in two different ways. The first is that the display isn't nearly as power consuming, so the display on the MacBook Air is not as good, but it also doesn't draw nearly as much power. Mm-hmm. So you're gonna find that your battery life on the MacBook Air is going to get you closer to a 12-hour day, depending on which model you have, whereas the Surface Pro 3 will get you closer to an 8 or a 9-hour day. Depending on what you have running and what you've done with it. And while the 8 or 9 hours is probably good enough for, a lot of people, it's also worth keeping in mind that the power cords that these two machines come with are also pretty wildly different. Apple's power cords are significantly longer than the industry standard, and they hold up pretty well, whereas Microsoft's included cable is really cool because it has an additional USB port, so you can also charge your phone from the power brick, but it's a lot shorter. While this current generation has proven to be more durable, the last generation, I actually kind of broke two of them. So I've yet to damage the current version, but the history has not been kind to the Surface power cords.
Yeah, hasn't the battery life issue been rendered kind of irrelevant if you have a decent power cord? And so many places are giving you options for powering up.
There are tons of places where you can plug in, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, convenience, especially on a school campus. But I feel like, you know, that it is really empowering to not have to reach for your power cord and put it in your bag when you go to leave your house for the day. And so that's something that, if you can, you know, have that experience, then it's certainly worth taking advantage of.
We have an email from Justin who writes, has anyone investigated how much actual productive schoolwork the kids are actually getting done on these devices? How much is really just social media, shopping, gaming, and other non-productive activities? People seem to justify giving a child a device because they need it for school, but is that really what is happening? Russell, what do you think?
There is certainly an argument to be made for the amount of distraction that goes into having a personal computer on a school campus, but it's also... that's up to the individual student. I can't say that there's a universal answer that applies to that. I know that, I have two brothers who play a ton of games on their computer, but they are also fantastic students, both of them. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly some time balance that goes into that. On the other hand, I get terribly distracted on my computer when it comes to playing games and things like that. And while thankfully now that's part of my job, in school, it was definitely not my friend to have that game sitting on my laptop when I was supposed to be getting a paper done. So, it's really, there are tools, there are applications that make it really easy to lock those things down. When you go to, get some work done, it really just depends on the student. You know, I really honestly don't think that there's one answer there.
And you did mention the price points are close. Tell us what they are. How much are these? How much do they cost?
So the base model MacBook Air for the 13-inch version and the Surface Pro 3 that's running the Core i5 processor will both start at about $1,000. Mm-hmm. The Surface Pro 3 has a Core i3 version, which is, I think, $799. But that price doesn't include the keyboard attachment, which is another $130. So you're hovering right around $1,000 for the base model for both of these.
Okay, and then just briefly, I didn't ask you to, but if someone needs to be around the $600 price point, what is your recommendation?
If someone needs to be around the $600 price point, it is interesting to consider. There are some options from Samsung as well as from Asus that are not quite as powerful. The battery life suffers in a couple of places. And the screens are not quite as good. But as far as, just a computer to get the job done, then those machines definitely exist. From Samsung and Asus, there are Windows 8 machines that do a pretty good job, being a basic laptop. And sometimes that's really what you need is a basic laptop. So
okay. And we've been talking about laptops, but what about desktops? Is there any reason for students to consider buying desktops these days?
You know, it honestly depends on the kind of work that you're doing. I mean, we still have a pretty interesting selection of students who do things like, video production and, maybe programming or something like that. And, in most of those situations, there is a designated school computer that, a lot of those kind of resource intensive things can be done. But sometimes you have to do things like, book time to use those and make sure that you get the work done within that book time. Otherwise you get yourself in trouble. So for those cases, it's really still, if you're building a Windows machine, if you want a Windows machine, it is still usually significantly cheaper to build it. And if you are looking for something that is just the most power and you're not concerned with price, then Apple's Mac Pro is a fantastic, very small machine that would be, decent for a dorm room. But there's really, there's such a wide range there that it's really hard to say. I think most students would be, reasonably suited with a laptop, but there are certainly still cases where, you need the kind of performance that a laptop just can't offer.
Mm-hmm. All right. You wanted to talk about cell phone chargers and in particular Nomad Plus. It's great because cell phones are always dying on us. So tell us about Nomad Plus.
Yeah, I mean, so, especially if we're talking about, the kind of equipment that kids should have when considering going to school and spending, 12 to 14 hours on a school campus, your phone doesn't always last that 12 to 14 hours. I know mine certainly doesn't, but I'm not normal, as I keep being told. There's this charger, and on the surface it looks just like a normal power adapter. You plug your USB cable into the brick and the brick plugs into the wall, but the brick is also a battery. It's a 1500 milliamp hour battery, so when you remove it from the wall, that power brick holds an additional 1500 milliamp hours, which in most cases is enough to get 50 or even 60% of your total battery that's in your phone back to you. So what you end up doing is spending the, I think it's $40 in some cases, but I think their pre-order right now is $27 on the Nomad website. And you can get one of these chargers and it holds, more than enough battery power to get even me throughout the day.
Now, when you say the word brick, it sounds really heavy.
No. So it's just this little tiny plastic block. It's a little tiny bit bigger than your current smartphone charger, the part that plugs into the wall.
Okay.
But it's really just that, it's the two-prong outlet with a little bit of plastic on the other side holding the battery.
Okay. Are there a lot of products like that on the market?
There are a lot of portable batteries. I've seen so many portable batteries, but they are usually these kind of separate blocks of plastic that, ideally you would store in your bag and you would keep a USB cable to plug into your phone. What's interesting about this is that it is also a, power adapter where you physically plug it into the wall, and it's only $40. So this ends up being just kind of a better travel solution, I think.
Now, you wanted to talk about waterproof apps and games being developed for those of us who study underwater, apparently. I don't know. Tell us about what games can we play with our phones and water, and why would we?
So we're starting to see a lot of water-resistant phones. The Samsung Galaxy S5 had a special sealed battery compartment that made it water-resistant. And Sony, for the last two generations, has been working on highly water-resistant phones. But what Sony did with the launch of their most recent phone, which is the Xperia 1S, was really interesting. They took their phone, they handed it off to a development firm who made six different applications that specifically require the use of holding your phone underwater in order to use these applications. And it's a silly demonstration to show, you know, hey, our phone is waterproof. But at the other end of that particular spectrum, it's really fascinating to see that there are, you know, not necessarily practical, but you know, fun applications that involve, you know, how your phone reacts to being wet.
Okay, so what's the science behind that? How does the phone know that it's underwater and that only certain apps can work then?
Well, so when the touchscreen is on, it can detect, you know, individual touches, and it does that through, you know, kind of a conductive process. And when water touches multiple parts of the screen at the same time, then, you know, those conductive parts are touching. So when the entire screen is covered and those conductive parts can all be activated at the same time, then you're either taking your phone and holding it up against your stomach, or the phone is likely underwater. And so using that, as well as the ambient light sensor that's on the front of the phone, it uses those two things to determine whether or not the phone is wet, and uses that to activate the applications.
I mean, I think there's a lot of things. I can imagine people who boat, you know, think you do want to make sure, just for safety's purposes, that your phone will work in case you're man overboard or something like that. But And I get that Sony's making these games to demonstrate, but beyond that, what are you going to do, sit in your backyard pool and play with your phone?
Well, part of it is, you know, just for, you know, just for silliness as far as these
right.
games go. But I have a younger sister who, in the course of her phone-owning experience, has drowned, I think, four different phones. And, you know, some of them have been, you know, she's had them in her pocket and she's been cleaning the, you know, the pool, and she reached into her, you know, pocket to answer a text message and it fell out of her pocket. Once it got dropped in a sink full of water, once it got dropped on a regular puddle on the side of the road. You know, it is one of those things where up until I started, you know, getting those phone calls from my sister going, hey, you know, so do you have any ideas for a new phone for me? Mine is dead. Until I started getting those calls, I used to think that, you know, having a waterproof phone was just kind of this neat little gimmick thing. But really, you know, there are a surprising amount of people who drop phones in water, and a lot of them don't respond particularly well to that. It's, you know, it's something that technology, smartphone manufacturers could certainly be doing better. And people like Sony and Samsung are certainly doing better. The people that work at those companies are putting some pretty serious thought into it. But there are still a lot of other phones out there that don't work nearly so well when you get them a little wet.
Okay, waterproof phones. It makes sense now that you talk about your sister. Gosh, we all know somebody like that. does it affect the price of the phone very much?
No, usually it doesn't. You know, I mean, both the Galaxy S5 is the same price as the Galaxy S4.
Okay.
And the Xperia Z1S is still a pretty reasonably priced phone, although it is only available in one place here in the U.S. So it's just one of those things where I'm sure in manufacturing it costs them a little more, but we don't usually see that price reflected in the bottom line.
Right. You wanted to talk about Diablo 3. It's a game. For those of us who don't know, tell us about it. We've got just about a minute and a half left.
Sure. Diablo 3, the Reaper of Souls Ultimate Evil Edition, is the whole long name for this game. It is available on the Xbox One and PlayStation 4 today. It just came out today. I have been playing it for a week. If you have played a Diablo game before, you know exactly what to expect. It's kind of a dungeon crawler. You know, choose a character and you run around and beat up bad guys and, you know, fight demons and stuff like that. But it's, you know, on the console, it's really a fun experience. It definitely takes advantage of having that controller versus having a mouse and keyboard. So I would say that.
Check it out. Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us today, as usual.
Thank you for having me.
I don't think you're too weird.
Ha.
Ha. Russell Holley's tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to everybody for listening today on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.